Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Easter Sunday, March 27th, 2016. This is episode 1274. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money to those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/techguy to apply for a loan now. And by Atlassian. Unleash your team's potential with collaborative software tools like HipChat and Jira, which will enable you to work and communicate better together. Visit Atlassian.com to learn more. And by NatureBox. NatureBox is dedicated to making smart, delicious snacking easy. They have over 100 ridiculously delicious snacks that get delivered directly to your doorstep. Visit naturebox.com/twit and get 50% off your first box now. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk about computers and the internet and home theater and digital photography, smartphones, smart watches. Have I left anything out? If it's got a chip in it, we'll talk about the Amazon Echo, too. If it's got a chip in it, I'm here to talk about it. Echo's a, boy, I love talking about the Echo. I probably shouldn't, since it's not, I don't think it's in widespread use. I'm sorry, I'm not talking to you. Oh, we have an Echo. She's responding now. Shh, go to sleep, little Echo. I don't know if it's in widespread use. Amazon pushed it like crazy on the Super Bowl. Remember those weird Alec Baldwin ads where he's talking to this black tube and ordering, I think, like $300 cashmere socks, which, let's be honest, probably doesn't speak to the average person. I mean, I guess it's good you can order $300 cashmere socks, but is that something everybody wants? I don't know. And yet the Echo does really cool things. You know, you can ask it for the weather, get a news update, get a timer. There's all sorts of new functionality. I see a company called Finn, F-I-N, at Finn.com, is building even more smarts. This is an interesting thing. Amazon has made this an open platform in the sense that anybody can design Echo commands. Sorry, I wasn't talking to you, Echo. I've turned her way down.
What you can say. Take a look at the things to try section.
Yeah,
in the
Alexa app. Yeah, okay, thank you. This is going to be a problem. I can't use her name now. And then this week, Amazon announced that if you have a Raspberry Pi, which is a really cool $35 computer, it's been sold mostly to education and hobbyists, you can put the Echo software on it. And then, no, she's talking. She thinks I'm talking to her. And then she lights up when I say her name. And then you can build your own, in other words, which is really interesting. Next week, they're starting to ship the new Echo Tap, which is a portable device. And then in a couple of weeks or months, I'm not sure after that, the Echo Dot, which is another little thing. It's a microphone only that you can attach to your speakers. And, of course, what is Amazon's interest in this? Well, it makes it really easy to buy stuff on Amazon. Like, really easy. You know, I think Amazon, we often talk about the five horsemen of the modern internet. Microsoft, maybe. Google. Apple. Facebook. Who am I leaving out? At Amazon. And Amazon is in some ways surprising everyone with its strength. It is, get ready for this, a $275 business that is growing incredibly fast. If you bought Amazon stock in 1997 at $18, it's now worth $675. It would have been a good investment, but that's not the only way you measure the success of its company. Perhaps by revenue, Not by income, because Amazon's interesting. They have a little dial. It's almost like Jeff Bezos, the CEO, has a little dial where he keeps income as close to zero as possible. But the revenue is soaring. In 2015, $107 billion in revenue, but they only made $500 million in profit, net profit, because they invest the rest. And man, that's a recipe for growth if you invest it in a smart way. Amazon's now bigger than Walmart. It is the largest retailer in the United States. Bigger than Walmart. Some of that's because Walmart is shrinking a little bit. But are they shrinking because Amazon's growing? Maybe. Bigger than Walmart. Amazon sells everything, of course, from electronics to groceries. But for everyday products, it is the most popular e-commerce destination. And the point is that this is just the beginning of buying things online. The upside for Amazon is massive. 51% of all online shopping during the holidays was Amazon. But only 6% of total retail sales last year came from commerce. That means Amazon, if it continues to dominate, is going to see huge growth over the next... I mean, you've got 94% of consumers not buying online. When they come online, where are they going to shop? Well, Amazon wants to make sure it's Amazon.com. And things like this Echo are part of the secret. You know, if they can get these in every house, and they're really useful, they're a little too expensive at this point. I think they're at $200. That's kind of pricey. But if they can get these in every house, and by the way, it's really easy to buy stuff with the Echo on Amazon. All I have to do. Wait, shall I give you a demo? I can give you a demo. Let's see here. Echo, buy some batteries.
I found several matching items in Leo's order history. The first is Amazon Basics AA Performance Alkaline Batteries, 48 pack. It's $13.09 total. Should I order it?
Oh yeah, please.
Okay, what's Leo's voice code?
Now that's how it keeps my kid from ordering.
Okay, what's Leo's voice code?
Now I'm not going to give it to you because then I would be giving it out in the public. But if I gave it the four-digit code, I would now have batteries on the way, and day after tomorrow, a pack of batteries would arrive. And it's anything you've purchased on Amazon. She just says, oh, yeah, you bought that once before. You wanted me to buy it again. Talk about an incentive to use Amazon. If you haven't ordered them before, it will put it on your shopping list. I think Amazon does that just to avoid accidentally, you know, because it's listening all the time. You know, if you accidentally say the trigger word, in my case, it's Echo, but it could be other words like Alexa, whisper Alexa, or Amazon. If you say the trigger word, then it starts sending whatever you say back to the home office. And if you should accidentally, or the TV, or some clown on the radio should accidentally say the trigger word and then say, you know, buy some stuff. You don't want to just run out and buy stuff. That would be bad. Amazon might like that. But you kind of want to slow it down a little bit. So there's a little speed bump, but not much. And the fact that I can be, you know, cooking or doing something and just think, oh, I need, you know, look in the drawer, oh, I need some batteries, and be able to say, get some more batteries, and they come. That's pretty amazing. It knows my address. It has my credit card. Bada bing, bada boom. Amazon's even eating into Google's business because people are now searching Amazon for stuff, not Google. How do you shop? You know, I used to often. I'm looking for, you know, a necktie. I would shop online by searching Google for neckties. Now you just go to Amazon and shop. You search Amazon. It's really interesting. And what, boy, how smart are they when they... with Amazon Prime. You pay them $100 a year for the privilege of shopping at Amazon. Yeah, sure, you get free 2-day shipping and you get movies and music and you can use your Echo to do stuff. I think you still have to have a Prime membership to use the Echo. So this incents people to spend that $100. It's really interesting. And that's not the whole of it because Amazon has other services you may not even know about. For instance, most of the apps you use, or the websites even, use Amazon's web services, use Amazon servers for their back end. So when you're looking at pictures on Tinder or Instagram, you're actually pulling those pictures from Amazon's servers. That's who Instagram and Tinder pay for the back end. That's huge business, too. They're the number one business in that. It's really remarkable. I don't know how I got off on this. Just looking at this black cylinder kind of got me thinking. Let's talk high tech. 8888-ASK-LEO. Yes, computers, the internet, and the Echo. Your call's next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. Kim Schaffer is here, suitably dressed. We both have our bunny ears on. Did you have a chocolate bunny a little earlier? Anything tasty? A treat?
No. Trying to stay away from those sweets.
Me too. I looked at them. Easter Bunny came to our house. You know, I didn't know this, but he leaves footprints. I don't know. What gender is the
asexual
Easter Bunny? Yeah. It's a bunny.
It's a bunny.
Anyway, he leaves footprints.
I didn't get an Easter basket.
Well, because you're too old, I'm sorry to say, for an Easter basket. But there was an Easter basket and involved many chocolate items. Mm. And I was very good.
I saw them on the shelves when I was trying to find these ears. But
yeah. I like your ears. You've got pink polka dot ears on.
And you have blue sequined ears.
Yes.
On.
And both of them match our outfits, which is
very strange.
Uncanny.
It was not planned.
So you've been lining up calls, I see.
I have.
Who should I start with here?
How about Rick in Long Beach and just more Windows 10 woes.
More stuff.
More Windows 10 woes.
Of course.
Continuous since July.
No kidding. Thank you, Kim. Right. Hey, Rick, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello.
Hello, Rick.
Hey, thank you, Leo, for taking my call.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling in. What can I do for you?
Yeah, I have an HP laptop, and you know how they offered you a free Windows 10, so I said, sure, why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
What could possibly go wrong?
So, I got a new printer, so I'm trying to load some software from an old software that I had, and it doesn't let me load it. It says an error like 1500, another installation in progress.
Oh.
Complete that one first before you can do anything else. But it's doing the same thing to my AVG anti-software. No update. It's not letting nothing update because it's another installation.
That may even be related. So I would remove the AVG. You don't need it. Mm-hmm. Windows comes with its own antivirus. Mm-hmm. You're using the free AVG?
Right.
Yeah.
I tried to unload it, and I just did it right now again, and it's telling me the same thing. I can't uninstall it because there's another installation in progress, it says. So, and that was my thought was, hey, I'll just get rid of it.
Well, let me of course, in the, install process, you rebooted, and you've tried rebooting because that would be one way to stop this. I am really not sure what's going on, but it sounds like something didn't wrap up. Have you been doing your Windows updates? Did you do all of those, and did they complete normally?
Right, the Windows updates do. They update no problem.
Yeah.
But anything else, it doesn't allow it.
Yeah. So there's an installer that many programs use that I'm wondering if AVG is using the same installer as that other program that isn't working. For a long time, there were third-party, you may remember this, third-party companies making installers for Windows. But eventually, Microsoft made its own better installer. And you know that those are installer programs when they have .msi on the end. That's short for Microsoft Installer. The Windows installer is the best and would probably not be having this problem. But I suspect this is some other Windows installer running, and it's gotten broken, and it's causing problems in general. So, I guess one thing we should check first is to see if Windows Installer is working.
Well, since I still have this uninstaller up here, it says additional message, MSI Engine failed to initialize.
Ah, it is the Windows Installer. Okay. So, yeah, we can fix this. It's kind of a complicated process. It involves the command line. Mm-hmm. You press the Windows key and type CMD, and then
you've got a long command line, but you're going to run MSI exec, and you can unregister it, and then re-register it, and that might fix it. Or you can uninstall it and reinstall it. But I'll tell you what, because it's such a complicated process, I'm going to put a link to an article from How To Geek, how to fix the Windows installer. This is for Windows 7, but it's applicable to Windows 10 as well. And there may even be, if you wanted to Google around, something even more applicable, if you just say, you know, Google fix Windows 10 installer. That's the MSI exec. That's what you're seeing. That's what's broken. So it's interesting. It's good to know. It's not some junky third-party installer. But it's broken. And this sometimes happens in updates and installs. Do you live in a subway?
I'm not too far from the blue line, and
it goes by. That's what you hear. I felt like I was in the subway.
We get those coming by.
I love it.
So long.
I love trains. That's nice. Is there ever anybody on it?
Oh, all the time.
Oh, good.
They're going to either Long Beach or they're going to L.A.
I'm glad. Light rail's great. I think light rail's fantastic. Everyone should have light rail. So that's not an unusual. It is unusual. It's not supposed to happen. But unfortunately, it's not unusual for a program to get a little corrupted or damaged. In this case, it's this uninstaller. I don't recommend using third-party antiviruses on Windows 10. It comes with an antivirus. You know, you could argue, well, it's not the best antivirus in the world. That may be true, but you already got one running on Windows. And my experience with antiviruses is, A, as we've talked about many times, they're not sufficient to protect you. Because nowadays, and this has changed, this is more recent advice than maybe 10 years ago or 5 years ago, viruses spread so fast that they usually spread faster than the antivirus can keep up. So the antivirus won't protect you, A. And B, it gives you a false sense of security. And C, and the most important, I think this is what you're experiencing, they can cause other problems. So I think I wouldn't be surprised at all if AVG is getting in the way. You know, it's broken, and remember, one of the things that antivirus tries to do is keep you from installing bad software. Well, if it's broken, it can block other things. It can even block internet surfing. So I think this is probably a good idea to fix the installer first, then uninstall AVG. You could also Google AVG uninstall. That might even fix it by itself. It sounds like AVG is the problem, I'll be honest. And there's really no reason to have it nowadays. Mike, Lafayette, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking the call.
Thanks for calling.
I was excited to get through. I was looking up this information and saw that you were on live, so I thought I'd call.
Think of me as your human Google.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. My wife bought me a DVD of the movie The Martian, which comes with one of these digital downloads.
Yeah.
And with the digital download, you have to choose, I guess, when you do it, either to do it with iTunes or Ultraviolet.
Right.
And then when I was looking at that, the problem is, and it's kind of perfect for Easter, we're an interfaith family. I have PCs, Macs, iPads, iPhones, a Vizio TV, and I'm looking at getting an Android phone. So I'm looking for something that I could do on as many of my devices
right.
as possible.
Right. This is because the movie industry doesn't want you to make a rip of this. And so they've got a horrible system with copy protection, and it's not working well. We're going to take a break, but we'll talk when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Just loathes Ultraviolet. And I'm wondering, is it the case that you can only activate one or the other, Mike, or?
It says you need to select your preferred service.
Uh-huh.
And the research I did indicates that you do probably get stuck with whatever you choose.
Yeah, and of course iTunes will work. Won't work on Android. It would work on Windows because you can install
right.
iTunes on Windows.
And it doesn't go to my TV because I don't have Apple TV.
Ah. And this is why, ladies and gentlemen, Hollywood's screwed. And you just should download a ripper and do it yourself because you can make an uncopy protected version. You know, they want to preserve the copy protection. That's what Ultraviolet is. iTunes also has its own copy protection.
Right.
So they want to keep you from making multiple copies of this, but that's precisely what you want to do, and legitimately.
Right.
So is it a Blu-ray or is it a regular DVD?
It's a Blu-ray.
Yeah. Blu-ray is a little trickier. DVD was cracked almost instantly by a high school kid. And so the movie industry said, you know, once cracked was never fixable. So basically it was a copy protection that never worked. And so the movie industry said never again. And they said on Blu-ray, we're going to do it right. But the problem is with any of these systems, you have to have a key so you can watch it. And the key's now in memory. And so now you can unprotect it. So we used to recommend a program from a company called Slysoft that has been since put out, just recently, like last month, put out of business by the movie industry, even though they were in Antigua. And they thought well beyond the long reach of the copyright police. What do we recommend? What do you recommend for Blu-ray ripping? I know you can still do it. Is Slysoft back? Last I checked, they weren't. Then I saw somebody say they were, and then I checked, and they still weren't. So maybe they're not. They're no longer at Slysoft.com, that's for sure. They're back as Red Fox. Oh, man. Can't talk about cat and mouse. Movie industry should just give it up. But it isn't. That's a paid program. I recommend it because it was about as easy to do as possible. This is what I would do. I mean, you're trying to be a good and decent citizen, but this is the problem with copy protection, is it's a pain in the keister and doesn't work very well.
Right.
So you want to have a Blu-ray ripper. There are lots of ways to do this. I'm trying to see. Handbrake is the one I recommend for DVDs.
And I've used that in the past. That was a couple years back with the DVD I owned.
So the trick with Handbrake is a little different for ripping Blu-rays because Handbrake doesn't have any, you know, cracking tools.
Right.
So you need something that will help. Download, install Handbrake. Start ripping Blu-ray with Handbrake. So the trick is, how do you decrypt it? Do you know, chat room, do you have a suggestion? Handbrake in a Linux VMware needs nothing else. You need Make MKV at makemkv.com.
Mm-hmm.
So just as with a DVD, you have to have VLC plus Handbrake, two free programs. For
right.
Blu-ray, you need Make MKV, and then you can rip it with Handbrake. So that's what I would do. It's technically illegal, but you own the disc.
Right.
And the movie industry brought this on themselves by this crappy solution, these digital copy solutions. So there you go. Just do that.
Okay.
Hey, thanks. Take care.
Thank you.
I didn't want to go on the air with all of this, so we're doing that off the air. But I'll mention it briefly.
Well, and it'll be on the podcast. So
and it is on the podcast.
Great.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Take care.
And in the show notes. Now, I think we probably have the recording of my standard anti-copy protection rant. We could just cue that up, play it back. I'll take a little break. No, I'll... So this is my call. This is it. This is the problem. Remember that when DVDs came out, there was copy protection on them. The DVD, the movie industry thought, really good copy protection. Man, we really licked this. Now people will have to buy the discs to watch them. And, of course, within, I think, less than a year, within a few months, some high school student, he's forever known as DVD John, cracked it. But unfortunately, by that time, enough DVD players and DVD movies had been sold that Hollywood could do nothing. And ever since, DVDs have been easily copied. Darn it. So then Hollywood said, well, we got this new format, Blu-ray. Let's learn from our lesson. Let's make something that can't be cracked. Of course, the problem is that the player, in order to play something back, has to have the magic key that unlocks the disc. Hollywood did say, well, we'll make that key revocable. so that if it is leaked out, which it has, of course, we can just change the key. And this is why, by the way, your Blu-ray player is supposed to be connected to the internet, and why every once in a while when you run a Blu-ray movie, it says, oh, I have to update. That's what it's getting. It's checking to see if the keys have been revoked and does it need a new key. To my knowledge, the keys have never been revoked because it would break any Blu-ray player that's not connected to the internet, which is, guess what, most of them. You'd buy a disc, you'd put it in your Blu-ray player, and it would say, I can't play this disc. You have to connect me to the internet. And then people would go, what? It doesn't make any sense to have a copy protection scheme that requires an internet connection. I mean, that's ridiculous. But this is the ridiculousness of copy protection. Look, I understand. You don't want your movie stolen. I completely understand this. But may I point out that the pirates have known how to... They're not stopped by this. People who want to steal movies will continue to steal movies in all sorts of ways. The only people ever inconvenienced by these Fakatka crazy, insane copy protection schemes are normal people like Mike who bought the movie and I just want to play it. That's who is inconvenienced. That's who's slowed down. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is that's who then learns how to use techniques to crack the movie. So you're just annoying people, movie industry. You're not slowing down piracy. It doesn't work. So stop annoying your legitimate customers. It's like when I pay $13.50 to go see a movie, and the first thing I see is an ad saying, don't steal this movie. It's like, dudes, anybody in this theater has paid you money to see this movie. You already got our money. You're talking to the wrong people. Okay, rant over. Can we record that and then I just won't have to do it ever again? We'll just put it on the website. The answer, Mike, is to stop trying to use these really terrible digital copies that they put on the Blu-rays because they're still copy protected. That's why you have to use Ultraviolet or iTunes. Their copy protection is broken. It's annoying. It gets in your way. It'll keep you from watching it on whatever device you want, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a simple Google search. How do I rip a Blu-ray movie? And you'll find 100 ways to do it. And guess what? The bad guys have known this since day one. They're not slowed down. My suggestion is get a program called Handbrake, which everybody should have. Handbrake, HANDBRAKE.FR. It's from France. Where obviously these people just don't care about the Hollywood. They don't care. And they've made a program that will take a Blu-ray and make it into a smaller, more convenient file that you can play on everything. And you can even in Handbrake say, I'm making this for an iPhone, I'm making this for an iPad, I'm making this for my computer, I'm making this for my TV. You can tell it so it chooses the appropriate quality, etc. To get through the Blu-ray copy protection, you'll need an additional program, but Handbrake will explain how to do that, or your Google search will. But that program is basically a DVD player or a Blu-ray player, and it just loads the key into memory. That's all. It has to be able to do that, or it wouldn't work. And, I don't want to go too much detail because I don't want the motion picture industry getting mad at me. Look, piracy is a bad thing. Please don't steal movies. If you love movies, if you love music, don't steal them. Support the people who make them. Of course, it's expensive. Buy the movies. But Mike bought the movie. Mike probably has already seen the movie in the theater and bought a copy of the movie. All he wants to do is put it on his phone. And you don't make that easy. So make a copy of it, Mike. And by the way, technically I guess it's illegal, but I can't imagine that anybody, any law, any court in the land would fine you for this because you own a copy. Now, don't make copies of movies you rent. You know, don't get it from the red box, make a copy of it, put it back. That's not nice. Be nice. Be honest. Be decent. Do the right thing. And I can say that. And you know what? There's plenty of bad guys who go, Leo, what a joker. Who will continue to rip the movies off. You know, that's not the solution. Prosecute those guys. prosecute those guys, not your users who are buying your movies. Jose, Santa Ana, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Jose.
Hey, Leo.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. I had a Dell Inspiron 15R laptop, and it was stolen, and it had a lot of, like, intellectual property, but I wasn't really, like, on a Facebook account. I had Google Chrome, and I didn't really do any backups. I didn't have a flash drive. I didn't think that I'd get it stolen.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That just sucks. You will back up from now on, won't you?
I will.
That's a hard lesson to learn, and I'm sorry that happened to you.
It's a terrible lesson.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm over it. And the thing is that I just recently got a text by Facebook saying that my passcode reset has been resetted, and they give me a passcode, but I don't have a Facebook account.
You don't have a Facebook account?
I don't.
What is Facebook thinking? So just ignore that text then.
Well, I'm thinking I do have my telephone information on my computer.
Maybe they're trying to get into your Facebook account. So you're saying that not only did you lose the computer and not have a backup, but you didn't have the computer itself didn't have a login or anything?
Oh, I had a Chrome account, a Google Chrome, and
your Google your passwords weren't in like a text file on the desktop saying passwords.txt, were they?
No, it was locked. It would lock, and I would
Strongly suggest on portable devices, that means iPhones and laptops, that you encrypt the hard drive. Both Windows and Apple have technologies to do that. Apple's called File Vault. Windows BitLocker is not available except on the Pro version, unfortunately, of Windows. But if you have a Pro version, use BitLocker. If you have a Mac, use File Vault. Encrypt it. By encrypting it, you're preventing a bad guy, even a bad guy who has physical possession of your laptop, from reading anything on the laptop. Because your laptop just had a login doesn't mean it was encrypted. That means they could take the drive out and still read it. So whatever was on that drive, you're going to have to change those passwords. If you don't have a Facebook account, nothing to worry about. How can they break in? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It's not that somebody is using your... So let's say they have your laptop and they know your phone number. If they're setting up a fake Facebook account in your name, they're not going to use your phone number because they don't want those password resets to go to your phone. They want it to go to their phone. So there's nothing to worry about when you get a message saying somebody's trying to log into your account or you've reset your password. Click this link to reset it. All that is probably, believe it or not, a wrong number. Probably has nothing to do with your laptop being stolen. It's because if you don't have a Facebook account, probably somebody has set up a Facebook account with a wrong number. Two cups. And now they forgot their password to boot. And so they said, send me a new password. And they're very disappointed because they didn't get one. You know why they didn't get one? Because they put your number in instead of theirs, one digit off or whatever. The bad guy is not messing with you in this case because you don't have a Facebook account. Now, a bad guy might try to set up a Facebook account in your name, but you could do that. I could do that. Nobody needs your laptop to do that. Then they're certainly not going to use your phone number for the password reset. That would be cuckoo. So I don't think you have to worry about that. Now, you do have to worry about the fact that you should assume that the bad guy has access to the entire contents of that laptop. Unless you used a whole drive encryption, which I always use on all my laptops because those get lost and stolen. So you don't, you know, if somebody has physical access to your hardware, it's pretty hard to keep them out unless you have whole drive encryption with a long, strong password. If you did that, then all they have is gobbledygook. They're going to sell the laptop for parts. Probably that's what happened anyway. really unlikely that whoever stole your laptop is now going through your stuff. They don't do that. They're usually, you know, junkies, and they just need the money. They sold it for $50 to somebody. Now, maybe the person who bought it got curious and started went through it. So you should assume that whatever was on that laptop, bad guys have now. But, well, I'll give you an example. Yeah, somebody's pointing out your browser stores your passwords in clear text. So if you can, somebody goes to Internet Explorer and says, what are my passwords? All your passwords will be there and not encrypted in clear text. That's true of most browsers. Because the presumption is, hey, if you have access to the hardware, well, we can't keep it private anyway. So any passwords you had stored in the browser, you must change. You know, I mean, I would change all your passwords. What else could be bad? Well, they have all your phone numbers, probably. They have your... Locked Slow-Mo doesn't matter. Let's say almost everybody has a login, right, to their laptop. The problem is that doesn't stop anybody. That's not encryption. You need encryption. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, I feel so bad for Jose. Laptop stolen or lost. He's worried now because all his stuff is on there. So let me talk a little bit about if you carry stuff around. I would do it on every, and I do on every computer, but certainly on a phone or a laptop. This is where encryption comes in. And we talk a lot about encryption because of this FBI and Apple kerfuffle. But this is why Apple put encryption on there. It wasn't to keep the FBI out. It was in case you lost your phone or you lose your laptop. It isn't on by default in most cases. It is on by default in the iPhone. That's nice. Android devices, it is not on unless you own an Android device made by Google, a Nexus device. But you can turn it on. And I would suggest doing so because once somebody has physical access to your hardware, your laptop, your phone, your tablet, they have all the time in the world to break into it and steal stuff. So turn on encryption for sure. File Vault on the Mac. Turn it on. On Windows, if you have Windows Pro, turn on BitLocker. I don't know why Microsoft doesn't make it available in Windows Home. That's unconscionable. They really ought to. There is hard drive encryption in your BIOS. Turning that on would probably do the job too. In fact, I think that would work pretty well. So you go into your setup. You know when you press F12 or Escape or Delete on boot before it gets to Windows? And then go in there and see if there's an encrypt your hard drive. Now, don't lose that password. It's okay to write it down. Put it somewhere. Don't keep it with the laptop. don't put it in your briefcase with your laptop. But, put it in your desk drawer. It's okay to do that. But you should do that. And I do. And because if you lose your stuff, people will just bang on it. Now, Jose didn't. Jose had his Windows login, but that's not enough. That's easy to get through. If somebody's really determined, the chances are 99-1 that whoever got his laptop has already sold it for $50 to pay for drugs, and that whoever bought it immediately wiped it, put Windows XP on it. So you're probably fine. However, if you're in his position and you did lose your laptop and you're worried, remember, your browser in most cases will expose all your passwords. The most important password to change, and you should change it right now, is your email password. Change it right now. Because, of course, if somebody wants to steal your other accounts, if they have your email password, they could just request a password reset sent to your email, and they'll get it. They may not even, in fact, if I were them, I wouldn't even change your email password. Because that way they can check your email and look at it all the time without you even knowing. So change your email password immediately. And then one by one, go through your bank, the most important accounts first, bank, credit cards, anywhere they could steal your money. Work your way through them, and then, your social media accounts, all of that. Change all those passwords. But the first thing to change is your email password, because if you change your Facebook password first, And then the bad guy goes and tries to log in and says, this isn't working anymore. He can request an email from Facebook with a password reset, which will get sent to your email, but he can read it, and then he can say, oh, good, let me fix that. And while I'm at it, let me get into everything else. So turn on encryption on your hard drive, on your phone, please. And this is why Apple's fighting so hard to kind of not weaken this. It's not because they don't want to help law enforcement. Of course they want to help law enforcement. Who doesn't? Let's help. You know, we want to catch bad guys. That's fine. It's that they're worried that if they weaken this encryption, then when you lose your iPhone, the guy who gets it will go, oh, yeah, that's not going to slow me down, and get in there. And now he's got all your stuff. You don't want that. 8888-ASK-LEO. And then, by the way, back up. I feel so bad for Jose. Robert, Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Leo.
Let's talk.
I can't believe I got through.
I'm glad you got through.
I love your show, and I love how polite and how concerned you are with all your callers.
Thank you.
But there's one thing I don't understand. I mean, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but how come Apple has this huge team of lawyers and they just don't tell the FBI in court, look, you're the FBI. Just send a request to the NSA on that phone number and bring it right here in court and show us what the NSA, the federal government, which who the FBI is, what you have. I don't understand that.
Well, I think they have. I'm sure they have. So, first of all, and this is, by the way, one of the points.
They didn't tell me. They didn't.
Apple made this. If you read Apple's response to the FBI request, they made this point. You have a lot of information. You know, you go to the. It's not just the NSA. You go to the phone company, and you will have all the texts sent and received by that phone. You'll have all the numbers that phone called or received a call from. You'll know the location of that phone at all times. You're going to get a lot of information just from the carrier, from the phone company. The NSA and the FBI, there are rules about how they can work together. Remember, NSA is not supposed to work domestically. It is it is a spy organization for international spying. FBI is the domestic law enforcement. So there are rules about how they can cooperate, although you're not far off because the NSA just announced they would be helping local and national law enforcement with information from their databases. So you're not far off. It may well be the FBI's done that. See, here's what I think. The FBI doesn't care what's on that phone. They really don't. The two phones that were the personal phones of the terrorists, let's call a spade, of the terrorists, were destroyed before their shooting incident. This phone was not destroyed because it wasn't owned by the terrorists. It was owned by the San Bernardino County Department of Health. And so it's a government phone. It was the owner, as should all of you be, know that when you have a phone that's owned by the company you work for, nothing is private on that phone, even while you're using it. So I don't know how smart this guy was. He's obviously not very, but he probably didn't destroy that phone probably because he'd never used it for anything nefarious. He'd be foolish to. He had his own personal phone. The FBI doesn't really care about this phone. In my opinion, the FBI wants to set a precedent. They merely want to establish that that they can go to Apple and say, you need to write new software that lets us into this phone.
I understand that. But if Apple can show, Apple is like, say, on our side. If Apple can show that they're, like, okay, the NSA could be a rogue agency.
No, Apple did say, in fact, here's more information. Before this went public, Apple said to the FBI, Ixnay, shut up. We'll help you. Just don't make a big deal about this in public. We can help you. For instance, let the phone back up. We'll give you the contents of the entire backup. No problem. The FBI then said, oh, well, we changed the password now. We can't. Because this is stupid. Or is it stupid? Either they were dumb and did the wrong thing. Apple said, if you'd asked us, we would have told you this, but you didn't ask us. Or they didn't really want this. They didn't want this to go away. They made it public. They want a court decision.
I understand the FBI's point of view. But the point of view for American citizens is, when they made this huge organization called Homeland Security, they were supposed to all fall under that control.
And I think I think you're right. No, I don't think you're wrong. I think
because they're not calling the NSA's bluff.
We don't know that, Robert. They're never going to say, "Oh yeah, we asked the NSA." In fact, this has all been put on a back burner because someone, no one knows, said, "Oh, we'll help." Maybe it was the NSA. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let me talk a little bit about our sponsor for the podcast today, the great folks at Prosper.com. I am a Prosper fan. I love this idea. If you need to borrow money, up to $35,000, get it in your bank account in as little as 5 days, what are your choices? Well, a bank loan's not going to be that fast, not to mention that you have to go hat in hand to the bank and fill out a lot of forms. It's just a pain in the butt. Credit cards? A lot of people do that. They run their credit cards up with cash advances. That is such a bad idea. If you've ever done this, you know the interest rates are so high on credit cards, it's impossible, almost impossible to dig yourself out. I had as a young man, about $30,000 in credit card debt, and it took me years, 5 or 6 years, of not using that credit card to pay it off, just because of the interest. But they didn't have Prosper when I was a young man. See, you can now see this is so cool. It's what it is. It's a lending marketplace. It's a peer-to-peer marketplace. So it brings people who need money, who want to borrow money, together with people who have money to lend. Investors. By the way, Prosper, I know a lot of people who invest at Prosper. It's a great investment opportunity because they vet the borrowers. The borrowers are great people that pay it back, and you make good interest, better interest you get in a bank. But still much, 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 much lower interest than you'd ever pay a credit card because it's a fixed rate loan and it's a low interest rate. In fact, you can find out right now if you want to borrow up to $35,000 to pay off those credit cards or to build go on a vacation or build an addition to the kitchen or whatever, go to prosper.com/tech guy right now. This won't affect your credit. This is nice. But you can fill out a very quick and easy form and find out exactly what your rate would be, how much you could borrow, and what your rate would be. And so there's no mystery at all. And you don't have to put on pants. You can do this in your browser. And you don't have to charge up your credit cards. In fact, this would be a great way. I wish they'd had this. I wouldn't have taken 5 years to pay off my credit cards. Prosper.com. It's kind of like the internet's answer to the big bank loan, like Uber or Airbnb. It's just changing how people borrow. Prosper.com/tech guy. For up to $35,000 in your account, as few as 5 days. Prosper.com/tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, smartphones, smartwatches, digital photography, and more. 8888-ASK-LEO. We'll be talking with our returned explorer, Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, in half an hour. He is back from his visit to Siberia, Lake Baikal, and we'll talk a little bit about taking pictures there. Really amazing. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's about half an hour from right now. But let's get back to the phones, and Rick in North Carolina is next. Hi, Rick.
How you doing, Leo?
Well, welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Well, I have two questions. The first one may be easy. And the second one, maybe not. But
okay.
First question is, why is it when I go to the Play Store, everybody wants to know my contacts, my photos, my Wi-Fi information, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, Sharks versus Plants does not need all that, but...
Well,
are they all becoming just a big information gathering network?
Yes and no. So they both Apple and Android now, and they have forever, require developers to ask you for permission to access stuff. And they chunk them up. So you know, they don't want to ask you 100 questions. So it's chunked up, like access to text message, reading, writing, sending, et cetera, access to the phone, which would include this, this, and this. They're bigger chunks. Otherwise, they'd be asking you question after question after question. Android's recently changed to do what Apple has always done, which is ask you at the time that it needs it instead of up front. Used to be you'd install an app in the Play Store as part of the installation and give you this list of stuff, and then you'd either accept it or not. Now it's more like Apple, where it still gives you some list of some stuff, but it doesn't ask you, you know, it doesn't need contacts until it needs contacts, and then it asks you. A lot of apps have gotten good about explaining why they're asking for this before they do. Sometimes it's legitimate. For instance, people freak out when they say, because they see the permission that allows an app to send an SMS, but that's part of the overall text message permissions, and the app might need text messaging to verify your identity, for instance. So it'll send itself a text message to verify you. WhatsApp does that, for instance. Now, I agree with you. Asking for contacts is fraught with peril because, of course, it could, in theory, mine your contacts for people you know and market to them, things like that. And you don't really know what it's going to do with them, unless the app says ahead of time. Now, Plants vs. Zombies maybe has a feature in it, I don't know, that says, would you like to see what of your friends are playing Plants vs. Zombies and invite them to play with you? Games sometimes do that. For that, they would need access to your contacts. WhatsApp will allow you, for instance, to find friends who are using WhatsApp. Well, for that, they need access to your contacts. There was a bit of a scandal. Was it with WhatsApp, with one of these apps, that they were downloading your contacts and keeping that database? And they said, well, we do that because it's an ongoing process. Every time a friend joins, we compare it with your contact list just so that we can send you a notification. Hey, your buddy Joey's joined. If you ever get that from an app, then you know they have your contact list. They're keeping it on their servers. So the answer to your question is yes and no. It may be a legitimate request, and often these requests seem broader than they need to be because the best thing for an app to do is to say, hey, what we're going to need is this, but in order to get this, we have to ask for permission to access all of your contacts. That would be nice. Some apps are starting to do that. So it really comes down to, you know, I got to be honest, it comes down to whether you trust the company that made the app or not, period, no matter what.
Okay, my second question.
Yes.
Windows 7 versus Windows 10s, what is the big difference other than Windows Media Player? And if there's nothing else, why not upgrade? And I'll listen off the air.
Okay.
And thank you.
Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. So very important. A lot of people make this mistake. Windows Media Player is included in both 7 and 10. What Microsoft stopped doing is Windows Media Center, because they said nobody used it. And what it was that lean-back experience so you could watch TV on Windows. So if you ever launched Windows Media Center, the whole screen would change to big letters. It was designed for viewing television, movies, listening to music. And they say nobody ever did it. And most of the people who launched it and then quit it immediately because that's not what I want. Probably they were looking for Windows Media Player. Microsoft's fault. I understand the confusion. It's not your fault. Microsoft's fault. But that is one big difference. Windows 10 not only doesn't have Windows Media Center, they erase it if you have it. If you're upgrading from 7 and you have Windows Media Center, they'll delete it. They say, we haven't updated this since 2009 in 7 years. We're not going to support it. You shouldn't have it. There are plenty of other ways to do this. I disagree with that, but hey, it's their operating system. More importantly, and the biggest difference between Windows 7 and 8 and 10 is under the hood that you won't see. You know, for instance, Windows 7 has a very broken, as does all previous versions, a very broken file copy system, which was fixed in Windows 8. But you might not even notice that. It's just a more robust file copy system. Security is very different between 7 and 10, and much better, I would say, in 10. Some would point out, if you're worried about privacy, and I think you are because of your previous question, Windows 10, by default, gathers a lot of information about you. Part of that so that Cortana, its virtual assistant, will work better. You can turn those off, But the default is that it's sending information back to Microsoft about your use of Windows, about things you're interested in, all sorts of stuff all the time. Some people would say Windows 10 is a privacy disaster. I disagree, but I want you to have the complete story. The interface has changed. Remember, Windows 8 introduced a tablet interface to Windows 7 that was not there previously. Windows 7 was very much a what we call a desktop interface, as you would use with a laptop or desktop computer, with the start menu and everything. With Windows 8, they eliminated the start menu. They brought these big buttons in. They really went to a tablet interface. People complained. So Windows 10 is a hybrid. They backed off on the tablet interface. It's still in there. In fact, you can switch to tablet mode on Windows 10, and it'll look much like Windows 8. But they brought back the start menu. And for people who used and loved Windows 7, tried and hated Windows 8, Windows 10, I think, is a perfect compromise. So I do feel like the user interface on Windows 10 is quite good. If you're a gamer, Windows 10 has a big improvement. It's got a new version of DirectX. It will give you much better game performance. And for gamers, Windows 10 is almost a certain upgrade. Now, why wouldn't somebody want Windows 10? Well, they may be running older software that doesn't work well with Windows 10. That's not unusual, or older hardware. And some people just say, I don't want my interface changed. I like Windows 7. I like it to look this way. I don't want to have this tablet interface. I don't want to have this new style start menu. And why upgrade if I'm happy? And for them, I think they have the right to say, I don't want to upgrade. I kind of think Microsoft is making a big mistake by pushing people into this upgrade, in some cases forcing people into this upgrade. But for people who aren't madly in love with 7, I think Windows 10 is a very good upgrade, and I do recommend it. There are compatibility issues. There are a few reliability issues. Those are being fixed very rapidly. And this is the future going forward. This is the Windows version that Microsoft is going to support. So, you know, willy-nilly, we're going to have to come along for the ride at some point. Unless you have a strong reason not to upgrade, I would upgrade to Windows 10. I like Windows 10. And I loved Windows 7. Windows 8, not so much. So I think Windows 10 fixed a lot of that. But you shouldn't be forced. It's your decision. There are some reasons you might want to upgrade. I hope that answers your question. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls. And Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, coming up. Rocco, Lancaster, California. You're next. Hi, Rocco. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Thank you. Two issues. Is there a keyboard that's available for just adding to a desktop? Because I have vision and motor skill issues with all the buttons that are actually on, just the letters and the numbers, where I can be able to print or type without having interfering with all the other buttons that I don't have any use for.
You want a special simplified keyboard.
I'll do that just for people that have older people. I'm a senior and just motor and vision issues.
Absolutely. There are quite a few of these. Living Made Easy is a website in England, but they make a really nice set of devices designed for computer input for people with various ability issues, varying ability. They have some great keyboards with big, colorful keys that are easy to press. Now, I imagine they sell these in the United States. Let me just check the big button USB keyboard from Key Needs.
Yeah, I'm talking big buttons, big dollars.
Big. No, you know what? 17 pounds, which is probably about $25. And then here's one that is very expensive, made by a company called Hypertech. It's 120 pounds. That's more like $150. Let me see if we can find it in the U.S. here.
I don't have any money.
The other thing you might check is a local independent living resource center, that kind of place that would offer you some assistance in this kind of thing.
But this is called Living.
Keyboards should be livingmadeeasy.co.uk. Now, that's a British company, so let me find somewhere that's local. But we'll put that in the show notes at techguylabs.com. But this is absolutely, there are quite a few. Hypertech, which makes one of these keyboards, is a Canadian company. Hypertech.
Well, countries I don't care about.
I know, as long as you can get it, right?
I'm talking about availability and cost.
Yeah, let me see if Amazon sells these keyboards that make it easy for you to order them. But the short answer is there's lots of these for a variety of special needs, and it's, you know, not necessarily expensive. A keyboard shouldn't be expensive. They should be very simple. You might try going to a Fry's or a Walmart and seeing if they have large key keyboards. I'm told that they do. Just big keys, easy. A lot of companies make them. The HyperTech 119 is probably more than you need to buy. But I see one for 17 pounds. That's like $25. So I tell you what, we will cast around. We'll find a few and we'll put them in the show notes. I don't mention the show notes enough. I ought to. TechGuyLabs.com. And that's free. There's no sign up. It's just a wide open website. And we put all the questions and answers there as I do the show. And then we update them after the show with, you know, more detail, plus the audio and the video of the show. And it's all divided up by day, by hour, and by call. So you can drill right down to the call. And your comments are also valuable. So if you have experiences with large key keyboards or specially designed keyboards that make it easier to type, please add those to the comments. There's no charge to do that, no charge to view it. TechGuyLabs.com. TechGuyLabs.com. Steve in Traduco Canyon, California. Hi, Steve. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Well, it's time for questions today.
That's what I'm here for. I love it.
I've got two for you. And being a rather unusual fellow for my area, I'm into ham radio. And one of the things I do is decode signals that my computer listens to from the atmosphere to find out who else is on the air.
Oh, how cool.
This happens 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I rarely ever, you know, have to touch it. It works fine. But in upgrading the computers in my shack, or actually it's a small closet, I'm trying to get to less and less power consumption.
Right.
And one of the things I've been using is one of the little $100 Atom 2735 tablets. It's running Windows 10 now, believe it or not. And it just happily runs, you know, all day long, all night long.
What is the software? Is it special software that you're using, or is it something you coded? Or
no, this is WSJT-X.
Okay.
And it decodes a couple different modes that people communicate. It takes 48 seconds to send 13 characters, but you can do this with extremely low power and bounce your signal all around the world.
Neat.
I have no available antennas to me, living in an HOA condo, so I snuck a piece of wire. It lays on my roof.
That's what a great idea. So you send as well as receive on this?
Definitely.
Wow, how cool is that?
And with a 40-foot piece of wire laying on my roof, I've contacted all 50 states and several countries throughout Europe and Asia as well.
So there are a lot of other amateur radio enthusiasts using WSJT.
Thousands and thousands of them. In fact, if you go to pskreporter.info, you can type anybody's call sign and get a map of who has heard them, you know, throughout the last time period and on which bands they were transmitting, et cetera, et cetera. But my question to you is, what are your thoughts on these new, well, not really new, but they're hybrid tablet PCs where the displays are a little large, like 9 or 10 inches. It's the guts of a tablet. In usually a wood-shaped box.
Yes.
And it has more USB ports, you know.
Intel created this category. They call them convertibles or two-in-ones. Actually, Microsoft makes one. I'm holding it right now called the Surface Book. You detach the screen from it, and it's now a tablet. I think for
That's a Surface Book.
Yeah.
I'm speaking of things that are, that do not have, you know, i5 CPUs that gobble energy.
Yeah, you want something lower. Yeah. You might even look at, if you've got a HDMI-capable television in your shack, you might even look at these Intel Compute Sticks. They look like USB keys with an HDMI port. They're not very powerful. 1 gig of RAM, Atom processors, as you mentioned. They're made by Intel. $88 for one running Linux. For Windows 10, it's a little bit more, like $110. And so it's very low power. It can be powered, in some cases, by the USB port on the television.
Well, in this case, I've got to have things like a Ours 232 serial port.
So that's a little weird. I don't know. Does anybody make computers? I guess you could use USB to RS-232.
Yeah, I have a couple of STTI dongles.
Well, as long as you could, you know, all of these, even the PC Computer Stick has a USB port on it, believe it or not.
Well,
here's something I bought recently that I would recommend also. It's called the Kangaroo PC. And it's made by InFocus, the same people who make the projectors. It's $99, runs Windows 10. It's battery-powered, tiny little thing. Yes, these are all good. There are lots of good choices out there. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by Atlassian. I'm a big fan. It's so funny because I think, wow, this is very high-end stuff for developers and big companies making software. And then I realized, oh, wait a minute. We're using three out of these four products made by Atlassian. In fact, if you're a developer, you certainly know the name Atlassian. The Jira code tracker, the project manager. We used Jira when we were designing the new website. It was awesome. Our team was in Austin. We're here in Northern California. We could keep track of what they were doing. They could ask us questions and keep track of what we needed. It made it so much easier. We also used HipChat to communicate with them, and we liked that so much. We now use HipChat globally in the business. In fact, somebody just sent me an invite to a new HipChat channel that we're going to use for monitoring the new studio build. We use it for engineering, for ops, for show hosts. HipChat is awesome. It's kind of a instant messaging / video chat that has integration with all of the tools you use, runs everywhere. Just incredible. Then I asked Russell, he said, oh, yeah, we use Atlassian's Confluence to manage trouble tickets and things we're working on. Organize your work, create and share documents, discuss, centralize, organize. And then, of course, there's Bitbucket for the programmers that lets you test, review, and manage code in real time. Atlassian has it all going on, man. This is great software that we really couldn't run Twit without. If you're working on a team and you want to give your team everything you need to organize, discuss, and complete shared work, you need Atlassian. Check it out. Atlassian, Atlassian.com. Unleash the potential in your team and build what's next with Atlassian. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt's back from his jaunts all around the world. He's our photo guy, digital photographer, host of the Tips from the Top Floor podcast, leads workshops at discoverthetopfloor.com, and you led a great one. First of all, you had a vacation in Tuscany for a week, right?
Well, yeah, I went there just because I don't do enough vacations, you know?
Did you take any pictures in Italy?
Well, the problem was the entire long weekend was just one big storm with lots of rain. A few pictures came out, but we had amazing food. We had great wine.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with Tuscany, my friend. No, nothing totally, wrong totally at all. Nothing. And then from Tuscany on to Siberia.
Yes.
Was that a workshop?
That was a photo tour, a workshop with, I think we were 9 people in total.
Oh, how fun.
And we went to Lake Baikal, the world's largest, biggest, deepest, and clearest freshwater source, pretty much. It holds about 20% of the world's fresh water.
What? 20%?
Yep. And at its deepest point, it's about 1 mile deep.
And it is clear. I'm looking at your images of the ice. The ice is totally, like, it's like an ice cube in your fridge. It's incredible.
It's like glass. It's amazing. I mean, the ice is different at different places, and depending on the temperature, it kind of changes over time. But the temperature differences there are so massive that you have, let me get this correct, in summer up to 104 degrees Fahrenheit, and in winter down to minus 40
degrees
Fahrenheit.
So it's really the worst of both worlds. Okay, good.
No, it's amazing. I mean, in summer, it has nice beaches, and it's beautiful to swim in. In winter, it's a guarantee that this lake freezes over. It's huge. I mean, it's about 50 miles wide. It's about 430 miles long.
Man.
So it spans quite a long range. And we spent about 2 weeks, a few days in Moscow first, and then a few, the rest of that in and on, around and not in, around and on Lake Baikal, which was just a wonderful experience, a beautiful experience. The photography was of course amazing. I mean, this is
I love these images you took.
I could spend weeks there and probably not get bored because it's so diverse. The people are great, the culture is great, the food was great, the accommodations were great. It was kind of an all round fun thing to do. And we had drivers, we had three vehicles, and we drove all across the lake and visited towns around it. And
gorgeous. So is it part of Russia?
It is Russia. Yes, Siberia is part of Russia, and Siberia is big. I mean, it's on the on the east side of the Ural Mountains, so it's in Asia. Russia has this European part and this Asian part. Moscow is on the European side, and Siberia is on the Asian side. So there's a Mongolian influence there. It's wonderful. It's just very different. It's from the expectations that you might bring.
Wow, and you know, it's funny because our assignment is water. Chris has asked us to all submit pictures of illustrating the word or concept water to our Flickr group. And I wasn't thinking about this, but you have a lot of pictures of water. It's frozen. But that's water.
True. Very true.
Yeah.
So, we'll review those pictures next week. So,
very nice. Very nice.
But it was interesting. From a photography point of view, let's talk. I mean, I'm here to talk photography, so let's talk photography. A few things that I did not expect was that it wasn't as cold as I expected it to be. We were about 14 Fahrenheit at the coldest. So March is already starting to get a bit warmer. And I think the season where you can be on the ice depends when it ends, but it's sometime in April it will probably end. Then you can't drive on the ice anymore. But
boy, you have videos on YouTube of so-called driving on the ice, which means mostly doing wheelies. But I see
he did that for the camera. He was
a show.
Our drivers were amazing guys, and we asked them to do that for the camera.
Very. Where can people see all these images and videos? Is there a place?
Well, if you go to discoverthetopfloor.com, I've actually put a list up there because we on the spot when we were there, like within the first day, we decided to come back to go back to Lake Baikal next year in February. It's we've already signed up with the operator.
I want to do it. Back.
It's end of February, and we're at this point taking people on the list. We're finalizing the details, but it's definitely going to happen. And it's going to sell out. I mean,
you only take 9 people. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What fun.
So
what lessons, what photographic lessons have we learned here?
Well, first of all, minus 10 degrees Celsius, 14 degrees Fahrenheit, no problem for current batteries in cameras.
Oh, interesting.
The fact that the thing I used to tell people is keep them in your pocket, keep them warm.
Mm-hmm.
I had no problems whatsoever with a current battery. And I'm talking like cameras that have been built within the last 3 years, I would say. So that was kind of good because I brought way too many batteries.
Were you shooting Canon 5D Mark III? That's your usual.
No, still the 5D Mark II.
Mark II.
Still that.
Good.
So,
I don't feel so bad.
That is about 5 years
use.
Old, and those batteries are just fine.
Nice.
The change between the warm car and the cold outside also turned out to not really be a problem.
And people worry about condensation, that it might fog up the lens.
It will happen if you go out and stay out for an hour and the camera really gets to that temperature. But as long as the camera, I mean, you have the camera in the car on these kind of tours, we spend a lot of time in the car. We drive from A to B and then we go out and shoot for, I don't know, 30, 45 minutes and then come back in. That time is not enough for the camera to completely get to 14 Fahrenheit, and then you come back to the car is heated, the air is pretty dry there anyway, because cold weather the air doesn't the air just cannot carry that much humidity. So it turned out to just not be a problem. It didn't happen, nothing fogged up, so that was good. And
did you shoot with your camera phone at all?
I did shoot with a camera phone. Actually, the videos that you see on YouTube are shot with an iPhone.
Wow. That's always blows me away now that we carry in our pocket a camera that's as good as any point and shoot, minus the zoom, I guess. But boy, and better than most video cameras.
Oh, and in these conditions, you have plenty of light, so light conditions are not a problem at all. No problems with noise or things in the video.
How do you get there? You fly to where? You fly to?
Oh, you're flying to Moscow, and then we flew together as a group to Irkutsk, which is.
I know Irkutsk. That's near the Kamchatka Peninsula.
It is, yep.
And I only know that because of the game Risk, by the way. But it sounds like I'm very, very, you know, geographically sophisticated.
That's exactly where I knew it from, too. And I always ended up in Irkutsk and lost.
Irkutsk. You
know? But no, that's where we flew in. And then from there, it was, well, actually you know, the biggest surprise was in Irkutsk, we spent the first two nights in a Marriott hotel. So
it's traveling is so much easier than it used to be. And I don't know, I have mixed feelings about that, but
we also spent time in real Russian accommodations, but not really the comfort was there.
Did you drive a Lada?
No. What we drove? Well, two of the vehicles
looked like
you
had Range Rovers, like nice cars.
Well, these were the Toyota Land Rovers.
Oh, Toyotas.
And,
okay.
And one was kind of almost straight out of Hollywood. One of these high, big wheel vehicles with leather interior and stuff. Nice. So we traveled in style.
Find out more at discoverthetopfloor.com. That's Chris's site, and he's got links to the photos, the videos, and information about next year. If you want to go where it's really cold, Chris Marquardt. We'll see you next week.
Sure.
A review of our photo assignment. Don't forget, take a picture that illustrates. I uploaded a picture, by the way, Chris. I have one in there. I'm not going to tell you which one. I don't want it. No special treatment. It's on Flickr, our tech guy group. And if you get your picture up there, maybe you'll be reviewed next week. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I put one picture up there. I should put another one because I have lots of pictures of water. We went to the Mendocino coast.
But it's under your account, so I'll definitely
You'll
find
know.
It.
I know. It does say my name on it. Well, you know what I did? I bought that Leica Q, so I've been having...
Of course.
What a nice camera. Oh, my God. So Lisa in New York, Lisa's shooting the Sony A7S with the Leica 50, and I'm shooting the Leica Q, and man, it was fun. Beautiful. Man, there's something about the light you get from those. It's just incredible.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, that would certainly
be good for this.
Yeah. I call that.
Now, it looks like a lot of these are macro shots, yeah?
No. Most of those are actually either wide angle with a 24 millimeter or a bit of a longer focal length, 100 to 300, somewhere in that range. But most of the ones that you see something like really big in the foreground, that those are... taken with a wide-angle lens, The wide-angle, you know what? The wide-angle makes you get closer if you want a subject.
I kind of like
this
that.
One. The one you're just showing is a telephoto.
So you zoomed in on that.
I zoomed in on that.
That
this
looks
is
like
wide-angle.
Wide. Yeah, that's
a wide-angle. That's a zoomed-in kind of shot. Yeah,
oh,
that's
beautiful.
Somewhere in the middle.
I love the sky in that one. God, these
that was so beautiful.
Oh, look at that! Now you tell me that's not a macro, huh? Man, that
that's
good.
That's a regular telephoto shot, probably 200 millimeters.
I guess I can't tell the scale, so I mean, that for all I know, that's a 20 foot piece of ice. I don't know.
It was probably like more like 3 feet.
Oh,
you know, the thing that happens is the ice expands. The surface is so big, the ice keeps moving, and then it expands, and it's kind of tectonic plates crashing into each other, and then it folds up these pieces of ice, and you have these shards, these glass shards, like
it's beautiful,
amazing amounts of them. And sometimes you have these crevices that open up, and then water comes into water rises up in them, and they freeze over. So you have these lines going through the ice.
Wow.
It's just complete. It's stunning. Just a complete. It blows your mind. It really does. I mean, I have never seen any... I've done a lot with ice, you know that, but I've never seen anything as amazing as
glacial that. Ice always looks so amazing. It's such an interesting color, you know.
And the lake is so clear. In summer, if you drop a coin in it, you can watch it sink for about a minute. So
wow.
it's super clear, the water. It's, the ice is like glass. If you see a diver under the ice, and they do that, they dive, they dig holes in the ice, they will actually, you can actually like kind of wave
watch
at them.
Oh, man.
And it's like 6 feet of ice that you're looking through, and you watch them, and you wave at them, and you point them in the direction of the next breathing hole. It's, yeah.
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Yeah.
Well, welcome back. We missed you.
I missed you, too.
But next week, we'll talk water. Water.
We will. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Take care.
Take care.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. Let's get back to the phones. Gil is in Los Angeles. Hello, Gil.
Hello there.
How are you?
Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.
Well, I've been listening to you way back. What was that cable station, I think, before it became True TV or something?
It was ZDTV and then Tech TV.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and then now they're nothing TV.
Learned a lot, and you've been entertaining, too.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have a problem. In June of 2013, I signed up with Carbonite. And I was signed up till this past March 15th. Back in October of last year, my computer crashed.
Oh!
I called them up and they said, well, you get it repaired, come back on and you'll be back in business. Well, I did. I came back on and they could not find anything. They backed up since June 2013.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
How does that work?
Well, or not work, as the case may be. I don't know.
Because I called them, and they said they'd search, and they would call me back, which they haven't done. And then when I called them, they said we're still searching, but it doesn't look like we can find it.
You know, I mean, they're unfortunately at the mercy of whatever's going on, and that if it doesn't, if something doesn't get backed up or the Carbonite software stops running, it's not going to have a backup. So it does. It is a good idea with any backup. One of the reasons I like Carbonite is it's a good idea to check and see every once in a while, is it there? And that's one of the reasons I like Carbonite is you can do that. They have apps and they have you can log on right. with your
you know,
account.
I did that. I did check.
Well, if they had...
Fact,
if
you
they,
know, when I went down, I called them. And then when I came up again, it was January something. And they said, yeah, you're okay. Everything's all right. But then when I checked, and then I signed up.
Well, they can say, now see, that's not, and then maybe they didn't give you the best advice. They don't know if everything's there. They don't know what you're backing up. You have to check and see if what you think you're backing up is getting backed up. You can't, they can't tell you because they don't know what you're backing up.
Yeah, but if the contract ran until March.
Yeah, but no, but that's not the issue. It's if the software is not working on your computer, then it's not backing up. And so that's, and it sounds like that you don't have any, you were missing a long period of time, right? They don't know. They can't tell if what you think is being backed up is being backed up because they don't know what you expect. You have to check. I'm sorry that happened. I'll tell you what, though. Hang on the line. I'm going to get your email address. I happen to know some people over there. And we'll get you escalated to the very highest level and see if we can get you some help. There may not be anything they can do. If it's not backed up, obviously, they can't magically get it. And so it's really important when you have a backup solution, every once in a while, verify it. I don't care what your backup solution is. And it's one of the reasons I don't recommend things like the Microsoft backup program that comes with Windows, because those make a blob. They back up, instead of backing up individual files, they back it all up into a single giant blob. That's hard to check. Most of the time there's some sort of verifier that you can run on it and see if it's all there. But this is always a problem with backups. You have to every once in a while just look and see. So I generally recommend backup systems that essentially duplicate folders. And that's an easy one to verify. You can look, is the folder there? And then you look at the contents, are the files there? And then open one or two of them, make sure they're complete, or look at the file sizes and dates. It's easy to verify. And probably a good idea, no matter what backup your solution you're using every month or so, just make sure. What almost certainly happened is, for some reason, Carbonite didn't continue. You uninstalled it, it broke. You installed something that interfered with it. Your internet connection changed. For whatever reason, it wasn't backing up. And if it wasn't backing up, they don't have a copy of it. But I am going to escalate you. We'll see what we can do, because if they do have a copy of it, I'm sure that they would be glad to get it for you. The good news is about Carbonite, and any good cloud backup will do this. They back up your backup, and they keep versions over time. So, and it's on different network centers and different locations. Any good system is going to do that. So they're backing up too, right? So they may have to go into another backup and say, oh, well, let's see. Maybe is it in the Seattle data center? Maybe it is. So there's hope. I wouldn't give up, Gil. But I'm going to put him on hold. Let me see if I can remember how to do this. I push that button. Now he's on hold. And if you'll just get his email address, we'll make sure we get it to Carbonite. Margaret Burbank, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Margaret.
All right, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Okay. I'm calling you because I'd like to find out what is the cheapest and best internet I can connect my computer with.
Okay. How much do you want to spend?
Well, as minimal as possible. Because I am retired and I'm very low
sure.
income.
No, but you want to get on the internet, right? Who doesn't?
Absolutely, yes.
So there's two ways that most people can get online. One is through your cable company, and one is through your phone company.
Okay.
Cable company usually is faster, but it's usually more expensive. Although you should, do you have a cable TV subscription?
Yes, I do with the cable and Burbank.
Yeah, so you might inquire, make a call to them. What's your cheapest internet? And because you're already a television subscriber, they may have an inexpensive package. But that's the number you're going to use now as you shop around. The next step is, okay, now I know it's whatever it is, $30 a month is typical. You can get it for less. If you go to your internet service provider via your phone line, we call that DSL or digital subscriber line. And the thing that's interesting is the FCC told cable companies, you don't have to share your network. There's only one way to get internet from your cable, and that's through your cable company. But they told phone companies, you have to share. So you have a phone line coming into your house. Most people have two ways of getting internet, maybe more if you include satellite over through the air, but that's not generally the best way to do it. One is that big fat cable pipe. One is that big fat phone line. The phone companies were told you have to allow other companies to use your physical plants. So you can go to whoever your phone company is, AT&T or whoever, and ask them and get a price from them too. What's your least expensive internet? And then you could go to other third parties. And I often like doing that because the independent DSL providers, well, they're frankly less lazy. Remember the old Lily Tomlin bit on Laugh-In? We're the phone company. We don't care. We don't have to. No. They don't have to. They're a monopoly. So you may be able to get better service. Remember, it's in effect the same. It's the same lines. They have a switch in the network operations center as AT&T, but they may give you better service because they're competitors. They're trying to do a better job for you. And often they have lower costs. We have a sponsor in your area, DSL Extreme. That's one of those, but there's lots of them. SonicNet is another one. A friend of mine runs that one. There's a whole bunch of them. I'll tell you, probably your lowest price will be DSL Extreme. So call them too. Now you have three data points. Cable, your phone company, and DSL Extreme, an independent internet service provider. Pick the one you like. Now, let me tell you the differences so you know what you're going to get. Speeds will be slower for DSL, especially inexpensive DSL. And they're going to give you two numbers. They're going to give you the kind of maximum download speed. Note I said maximum, and maximum upload speed. They don't promise that you're going to get that speed. It may be lower, but they generally get it to that speed. For browsing, if all you want is email, browsing the internet, you're not caring about watching TV like Netflix, you don't care about streaming video, maybe streaming audio, that's fine, then the lowest tier they offer, which is usually somewhere around 1.5 megabits per second, is sufficient. That's enough for audio, browsing, email for one person. If you have more people sharing your internet line, you need more bandwidth. If you have a 1.5 megabit down, you'll typically have a 256 up, maybe 768K kilobits per second up. That's not a lot of upload speed. it's not enough really to do video phone calls. It's enough to do audio phone calls like Skype audio. It's enough to, you know, send an email. So it really depends on your needs. In general, the least expensive is good enough for surfing, email, and audio. If you want Netflix, if you want to watch high-quality Netflix, then you need to get to at least 5 megabits download. And 10 would be better. More is better. So there you go. And you can, you know, I think DSL Extreme starts at $15 a month. They may even have less than that. They've had it times $10 a month. That's pretty affordable. Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy. More calls right after this.
Here's some exciting.
Here's some exciting news, says Leo.
Chris is still in the chat room talking about his trip in Lake Baikal, and his newest podcast has some stories, tipsfromthetopfloor.com or TTF.com. Yeah, I agree. The phone company's customer service is terrible. It's almost always better to go with the internet, independent internet service provider, I think. DSL is always slower. Sometimes a lot slower, depending on how far away you are from the main office or the nearest office. Cable almost always go faster. I mean, my cable now I'm getting from Comcast, I think 150 megabits down. And there's no way DSL can do that. Yeah, basically what the cable companies have been doing is upping the cost of internet from them to make up for the loss of premium channels. So they understand you're going to start watching everything on, you know, Showtime, Anytime, and HBO Now and all that stuff. So they jack up your internet cost so that they don't lose any money. They're smart. They're not dumb.
I feel like all of my channels are going away. Certain channels that I had, not changing the plan at all.
Are just disappearing?
Just disappearing.
Like what?
Even ones that aren't premium channels, like Bravo or something like that.
Well, especially ones that aren't premium channels, because they... So what happens, the cable company says, okay, it's going to cost you another 50 cents per subscriber. And they say, no, we won't pay it. So the cable company says, well, then you're not on cable. Then they do this fight. And then people start buying ads. There was the Yes Network, which is the Yankees network in New York City, has apparently been booted off of the local cable. And they were, you know, they were all over New York City handing out schedules saying, Yes is gone. And it happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's a constant battle.
I flip through the channels going to look for something that I think is supposed to be there.
And right.
No, you're not a subscriber.
They had a crawl. I was watching a show the other night, and they had a crawl saying, Comcast is about to remove ABC or something like that, and you were going to lose all your locals.
I think that happened for me on NBC. Right. I have Comcast, but it was for Dish Network.
Right.
Said if you're a
right.
Dish,
if you're a Dish subscriber.
I'm not a Dish subscriber.
I know.
It's
ridiculous.
What are you doing on my TV?
I know. Mmm. Ah,
well, cheers.
Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, and all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. We'll go right back to the phones. And Mark in Lancaster, California. Hello, Mark. Leo here.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, thank you.
What can I do for you? Hey, thank you.
Well, I have a question on, well, two questions, but I'll do the first one first, obviously.
Okay. All right.
I have an iPhone 5, and I back it up to iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
And on my phone, it says that it's successfully backed up. Or if I look at my phone and go to backup, it says, you know, recently backed up yesterday, whatever. But if I go to my laptop, which is a PC-based laptop, it shows that the last time I backed it up was like a month ago.
Well, the backup is local to the machine you're backing it up to.
Okay.
So you're backing up to your laptop each time?
Well, I back it up to iCloud.
Yeah, the iCloud's different. Okay, so there's two ways to back up an iPhone. One is to the cloud, iCloud. And for that, you pay, by the way. You get 5 gigabytes of storage free, but after that, you're going to pay for additional backup. Now, 5 gigabytes on an iPhone 5 is probably plenty, but just be aware.
Right.
If you're backing up a Mac and another phone and a tablet, it pretty soon it fills up very quickly. And then the other thing, of course, is you can back up locally by connecting a USB cable to your laptop. And that's what you were doing with iTunes, right? And then you run iTunes and you say backup.
Right. Well, I was doing with the cable, and I back it up, and I would back up fine.
Yeah.
And then I went and I thought, well, maybe I should be doing iCloud. So then I went and I did iCloud. And I have an iPad also, and I have a lot of pictures on there and decent amount of music. So I went and spent the $1 to get the 50 gigs extra, which
good. Yeah.
Which is, I still have like 49 gigs, or no, not that much, but.
It's a lot, yeah. I mean, I pay $2 or $3 a month, and I have 200 gigs, and I'm never going to fill that up, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I figured if I'm back up to iCloud, doesn't that also sync with iTunes?
No, it's a separate place.
Totally separate.
And I would do both, frankly.
Okay.
The reason is it's very quick to get an iTunes Restore done. You just connect. So if you get a new phone or you want to reset your old phone, you just plug it in via the USB cable and you restore it very quickly. My suggestion, by the way, if you do a backup on iCloud, is do the encrypted backup of iCloud. There's a little checkbox there. And there are two reasons for that. If you use encrypted, it will then back up passwords and things like Wi-Fi settings, which is very handy.
Right.
So I would recommend that. The other reason, turns out Apple has access to your iCloud backups and will gladly fork them over to law enforcement when they ask. So
Without any jailbreaking
required. This is one of the things we learned from this whole Department of Justice versus Apple lawsuit is that, in fact, Apple said, hey, well, if you just had let the phone back up, we would have given you that. So they have access to that. It's my understanding if you encrypt it, however, only you have access to it. So, and now right, I'm not worried, and you're not a criminal, and, it's fine for law enforcement with a warrant to get your stuff, but as always, if Apple has access to it, it means also that a renegade, rogue Apple employee has access to it, and if a hacker gets in, they have access to it, and all you have to do is ask Jennifer Lawrence about that and how that worked out. So my suggestion is encrypt your backups when you back up to iTunes. Now, the iCloud backup, I don't know if you can encrypt that. I think you can't. So I think Apple will have access to that willy-nilly. But encrypt whenever possible. Always a good idea. Encryption is a wonderful thing, and we should all take advantage of it.
Absolutely. And then kind of tying into that, but on a whole different avenue here, we talk about Carbonite, and also we talk about, like, ransomware.
Yes.
So if Carbonite is updating it continuously, then doesn't Carbonite update the ransomware into its backup?
Absolutely. Great question. And Carbonite has a white paper on this, which anybody who is using Carbonite for business should absolutely read because it gives you best practices. The reason Carbonite is a good alternative, good backup in the case of ransomware is that they do versioning. So you can go back a version or two on your backup. So
back a day or go back 2 days.
Yeah.
What you need to do.
So the minute you say, oh, whoa, I just got bit by a crypto locker, you go on your Carbonite backup and you restore the backup previous to that. And then, of course, before you do that, get rid of crypto locker. But no, Carbonite but you raise a really good point. A lot of backup solutions don't do versioning, which means that they will back up the newly encrypted files, and you really be out of luck. I'm sure that's what happened.
Yeah, because when you restore it, then
you restore an encrypted file. Right. So the key to look for is versioning. Can I go to previous versions of that file? If I can, then as long as you catch the encryption soon enough, and you will because you'll open a file and it won't be able to open, as long as you catch it soon enough, you're okay. Before all the versions get used up, in other words.
Cool. All right, cool. I back up to a separate drive.
Yeah, see, that's the one that is susceptible to a ransomware attack, because that backup, if it's an automatic ongoing backup, unless you have multiple versions, you're vulnerable.
Right, right. No, I do multiple versions.
Ah,
I just change the file. I just change the file. I just take my whole My Docs and just back it up manually once a week.
So whatever the last backup previous, if you didn't erase it, that's the one you'll be going to.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
Very good. I'm really glad that you asked that question, because I think that's a really important. People need to understand that a backup isn't necessarily sufficient if you get bit by ransomware. Of course, the best advice is not to get bit by malware at all. And for that, it's not just take some normal prudence. Be very careful. If you get emails, often from friends or a bank or somebody you do business with, just saw the new scam where I think, what is it? They send you supposedly from the IRS. What would you do if you got an email from the IRS that said, hey, we got your tax return, but you didn't sign it? But no problem, because we have a new e-signature thing, so we've attached the form as a PDF. If you just open this, sign it, and send it back to us, all will be good. And it looks very official. Probably says things like government use only. Do not forward. It would be a violation of federal law, subject to a penalty of $20,000 or 3 years in prison. You know, lots of legalese around that. You might go, oh, gosh, maybe I better open that PDF and sign it. You double-click the attachment, and it says, oh, your PDF reader's out of date, and sends you off on a wild goose chase. Maybe you even get a form. Maybe you even get a form that you sign and send back. But meanwhile, when you double-clicked it, you also installed CryptoLocker, a ransomware virus, or some other form of malware, and didn't even know it. The bad guys got to trick you into doing that. The bad guy, in order for you to get malware on your system, one of two things has to happen. The bad guy has to trick you into running a program. Now, it may be called a PDF. It may even be a PDF if your Acrobat Reader is out of date and they can take advantage of flaws in Acrobat Reader that allow PDFs to install software. That's actually the case in some cases. But they got to get you to double-click or agree or open that thing. That's why it's really dangerous, really. Even, you know, you get that pop-up that says you've got ransomware. You know, here's a fix for it. Anything like that. Anytime somebody's trying to get you to run a file, be very, very, very suspicious. And it may often be somebody that pretends to be the IRS or your best buddy on Facebook saying, I got video of you from last night. You won't believe it. That's when your little warning alerts should go off in your head. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Just saw a new one. What was it? Fresno State. Lockie. Lockie's the new one. No, I was just reading in the news. Man, it's on Tech Meme. A new ransomware email scam was going out. I should really bookmark those when I see them so I can talk about them. Wow. Well, I'm never going to make fun of Ashton Kutcher again. He has started an investment fund, an angel fund. They took $30 million worth of investors' money. They've turned it into $250 million. Investments in 70 startups, including Airbnb, Uber, Shazam, Skype, and Spotify.
Wasn't he like the first person to get a million Twitter followers, too?
Yeah, he's the one who dethroned me and my ilk. Ruined Twitter forever. Damn him. This is a neat service I just signed up for, but it's you have to get an invitation called Privacy. I'm going to mention this one, actually. I really like this idea. gives you a burner credit card. Oh, my blood sugar right now, after drinking orange juice, not a good idea. Probably shouldn't be drinking orange juice, huh? Best way to encrypt your files. There are a lot of ways to do that. Free, Tino Hands. I mean, if you want full disk encryption, VeraCrypt, VeraCrypt, is a TrueCrypt fork that's being maintained. TrueCrypt is not, unless. But you can, you know, Zip has a strong encryption built in with its password protection. So you could just zip a file and that would make it encrypted. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. You know, there's a new service. Speaking of scams, this one's a good one that I want to recommend to you. You know, one of the ways you can get in trouble online, of course, is giving a credit card, inadvertently giving a credit card out to a scammer. Maybe you get an email saying, hi, this is from Amazon. Can you update your credit card information? and you had a couple of mimosas at brunch for Easter and you aren't paying attention. You go, okay. And you go and you fill in all the information and you go, good, I'm up to date now. You just gave a bad guy, not Amazon, a bad guy, all your credit card information.
Yikes.
So there's a new service. I really like the idea of. It's a free service called Privacy at privacy.com. And what Privacy does is you associate it with a credit card, and it works with many banks, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, USAA. And then you can generate one-time only credit card numbers, which you can use for purposes or whatever. The credit card number is not good ever again, just once. It goes to that credit card that you associated with it. Bad guy can get it. You can give it. You can say, here's my credit card number. They can't use it. Some credit cards, I think Discover offers this. Some credit cards do offer one-time credit cards, which is a great way to do it. The best way, of course, is to have it associated to a merchant. So, for instance, this is my one-time use credit card that only Amazon can use, except it's not one time. It's whenever Amazon needs it, but no one else can use it. It's got to come from the charge has to come from Amazon. Bad guy can't use it. Or if you're, you know, going to only buy something once from a merchant, use it once. It's a great idea. I just signed up for it. I love it. Privacy.com. A little tip for you. Fran Sherman Oaks, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi.
Hey.
Hey, so I have a computer that was an 8.1 Windows, which I upgraded it around Christmas. And just about 2 weeks ago, when I went to turn on my computer, I got a message that I had to choose a boot device, which I finally figured out. I did it. I went into the settings. Now, every time I turn it off and turn it on, that message, and I just got another message, the NTLDR is missing. Oh, but I did the same thing, and I found the boot device. And
okay. So there's a couple of possibilities here. Before you said that second thing, I thought, oh, she's got a stuck F12 key. Because all computers, when you boot them up, there is a key, usually, at least in the case of Dell's, F12, that will let you choose the boot device. So if that key were accidentally stuck or held down, every time you turn on the computer, it'd say, well, where do you want to boot from? But this second message worries me. NT Loader is the boot software. And it sounds to me like it's trying to boot from something else.
It is.
Yeah. So that you can fix in your boot order menu.
Okay.
And what kind of who made the computer? You said HP?
It's an Asus.
Okay. Uh-huh. So good computers. So I just have to look up the bootloader key. But when you first start up, it shows a big Asus logo. But there are buttons you can push at that point to change the bootload order. At some points, it was changed. And it was changed to a second drive. Well, who knows how it got changed. Maybe do you have a 15-year-old?
No, I have nobody else to do. Me.
I worried if your hard drive's starting to get flaky, this could be it. But I think it's more likely that the boot order was changed. So or the CMOS battery. How old is the computer?
It's probably about 3 years old.
Yeah, it might be the battery that backs this information up. is dying. You don't have a CD in the drive or something like that, do you?
No, I checked that now.
Yeah. Well, I would first figure out if your boot order is correct. Try pressing F12. I can't remember. Maybe somebody in the chat room has an ASUS can remind me what the key is. Sometimes it's escape, sometimes delete, but usually it's an F key, probably F12. And make sure the boot order is proper. You want to boot to the main drive, the C drive. Make sure you don't have anything plugged into the USB sockets, like a USB key. Anything that it can see as a drive, it will try to boot from if the boot order is changed. So you want to make sure it starts with your internal hard disk. If your internal hard disk is getting flaky, it could also cause this symptom, but you would still have trouble booting up. And it sounds like once you choose the internal hard disk, it does fine, right?
Yeah, it's fine after that.
Yeah. Press F12 right after boot, before Windows, before anything. Keep tapping it till you get a boot order menu.
Well, that's what I've done, and I choose the boot drive from the door.
Yeah, but you're choosing it temporarily. You want to change the boot order permanently. That means you need to get into the BIOS, not the temporary setting, but the BIOS setting. It might be F8, might be escape, might be delete, but get into the BIOS settings. And inside the BIOS settings, that's the BIOS is the thing that starts the machine before the operating system. And one of the things
I'm
you can
pressing delete to get into
delete sounds right. Yep. So tap delete, and then look at, there'll be an area of the BIOS settings. There may be many pages of these, but usually it's on the first page. There's the boot order. And make sure C is at the very top of the boot order.
Right. I mean, when I see it now, there's those two other things that I don't know what they are. And at the bottom, it says Windows boot device.
Yeah.
And I just guessed that that was the one.
Yeah, it was. So move that up to the top. Start there, machine. You know, I don't know how it would get changed. I bet you your battery's dying. If you fix it and it starts happening again, then you is it a laptop or a desktop?
It's a desktop.
Yeah. Then usually you can open up the desktop. There's a little dime-sized or quarter-sized silver battery in there. It's one of those lithium batteries. You can get them at any drugstore. You'll have to look on it and see what it is, CR2032 or whatever. Get that one and put a new one in. But first, press delete. Go into the setup, look at the boot order, make it be the Windows device. That should be the first thing it tries. If it doesn't try anything else, you won't see this message again.
Okay, great.
All right.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call. If, you know, other symptoms that your battery is dead is, you know, an inability to recognize various hardware devices, a date and time that aren't consistent. That go back in time, that actually can be a symptom that causes all sorts of problems. If your battery backup dies, it means it can't back up the date, and it will go back in time to 1970 or earlier. And then you get all sorts of weird things happening. For instance, you'll surf the web, and websites will say, no, you can't go to this website. The certificate's out of date. It's really not out of date. It's 30 years in the future. but from the point of view of the browser, it's not going to... No, it's not safe to go here. You're living in the future. Or you're living in the past. So there are other symptoms. But batteries do die. I mean, obviously, they don't last forever. And that's what's backing up those settings in the... they call it the CMOS, the complementary metal oxide silicon. I don't know why I remember that. Taking a break. We'll come back with more of your calls. Jonathan's next from Knoxville, Tennessee. He wants to know about tracking his internet usage. Comcast wants to know too, don't they? We'll answer your question in a bit. Sometimes the day goes, sometimes not. All right, I'm going to get the extension. Yes, add that extension for privacy. Now I need to, pay by privacy.com has been added to Chrome. And now I need to connect a credit card account. I will connect. What cards do I have here? Which card do I want to use for this? What happened to my bunny ears? Good question. I grew weary of them. Oh, This purse is so complicated, I can never find my wallet. Sounds like a party in the other room. I think they're having an Easter party. We've also lost Kim. She's joined the fray. So maybe I'll use my my company card. How about that? All right, let's use my company card. I need my Bank of America login. That's not a good one. Or is it? What state am I in? I'm in the state of inebriation.
Not yet.
Not yet?
Not nearly enough.
You lightweight.
Yeah.
Enter verification required by your bank. Alrighty. Alrighty. From the privacy.com team. Jonathan in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi, Jonathan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
Wonderful. How is it going for you?
Oh, well, doing okay. But I'm sure you're well aware, Comcast, the home internet, they've put data caps, at least in my area and some of these states around me, for 300 gigs a month.
Wow. That's terrible.
Yeah, and after that, it's $10 for every 50 gigs afterwards.
$10 for 50 gigs. Well, that's not awful.
Yeah, it's not awful. But so I noticed when they started it, it was probably a couple months ago, I was getting, you know, $20, $30 extra a month, you know, every time. And I wanted to see how I could track my internet usage. And I would notice online that people would say there was discrepancies where they had measured their own usage.
Right. Of course, I'm sure it says in the fine print somewhere, our numbers are all that matter. Have you been dinged yet? Because one thing Comcast did do is they announced these caps but never enforced them in many areas. Have they actually enforced it with you?
Yeah, I've had to pay those.
Darn it. 300 gigabytes is not very much, especially if you watch Netflix.
Yeah, believe it or not, I don't stream. I know I'm one of those weird people.
Well, then in that case, I would wonder how you got to 300. That's 10 gigabytes a day.
Yeah, and I work from home.
Are you downloading that's that big? Because, I mean, even streaming video, we're not talking more than a gigabyte an hour. So what are you downloading that's so big?
Just constantly sending, like, large Photoshop files via Dropbox or Google Drive. And I catch you on YouTube, actually, over the weekends.
Well, that counts. That counts. I can use up video.
Yeah, so, I do use YouTube a lot. But, I'm constantly hitting those caps, and I've got a ton of devices. I've got game consoles, got computers and phones and tablets. And it just...
Well, you can measure your consumption, and you need to do it at the router, obviously.
Yeah.
It,
I would love it if I could do it by device, if possible. I can see what each device is using.
You can in Windows 10.
Okay.
It's device specific. So some devices you can. Most phones you can see what your usage is. As I said, Comcast, I bet you in the fine print somewhere says it doesn't matter what you think. It only matters what we say, but Windows 10 will tell you in the its usage. I don't know if earlier versions of Windows will do that. I don't think Macintosh will do that. You'd have to run some specialized software on the Mac, although that wouldn't be too hard. Maybe Mac does. The easiest way to do it, though, would be to do it in the router. My Asus router will keep track of usage, and I think it has. I'll have to look, but I think it has per device breakdown. Even.
Oh, okay.
So you're trying to figure out who's the bandwidth hog in your house?
Right. Yeah. And they would even ask me, you know, is your network secure? Of course it is. Password on it.
Right.
And I try to keep track of what I'm using.
Do you have kids using? Do you have kids using the computer? Do you have open Wi-Fi? Is there any?
No, it's just me and one other. But we have all our devices hooked up to the same hotspot.
If you call Comcast, I know what they're going to tell you,
mm-hmm.
which is you should get a business account.
Yeah, and they do sell unlimited internet. I'm sure they throttle it.
Yeah, the business accounts generally are not capped, but you're paying a lot more. I have a business account; it's $100 a month, but I don't have to worry about bandwidth caps on that. I'm looking at the Asus traffic monitor interface. It has, it's pretty, I have to say, it's pretty sophisticated. But I don't know if it does, it breaks it down by device. I'll have to look at that.
For the record, I did buy a Netgear router. It's a cable modem, like it's an all-in-one modem router.
Yeah.
And it uses a Genie app, like it's Netgear Genie, I think it's called. And it will give you your up and down.
Oh, well, that's
good. Upload and download.
But it won't do it by device.
They won't do it by device.
Yeah.
Even if the numbers are off, it will report higher numbers than
common. Well, you can see it's... This is a challenge, isn't it? There are programs. I mean, there are much more sophisticated programs you could use that will give you lots more information. The problem is, you can't just run it on one computer. You need to run it somewhere.
Pretty much on every device.
Yeah, I mean, you can use Wireshark, for instance, to monitor incoming and outbound traffic on your wireless. If you could put a computer with running Wireshark in between your cable modem and your router. Or in between your router and the rest of them. I mean, there's ways to do it. But per device is tough, I think. I would look and see if the Netgear capabilities are there. Or maybe there's all third-party software. You know, a lot of times you can really improve a router's capabilities, performance, and reliability by putting other firmware on it, DDWRT or Tomato. Tomato is really fantastic, and see if the Netgear, if you could put Tomato on your Netgear, and you can see if Tomato would have that kind of information. But you know, if you otherwise, you're going to put a computer running pfSense or some sort of sophisticated routing software in between your router. Actually, you wouldn't need a router anymore. In between your cable modem and the rest of the world, and that'd become your router, and that could do it. In other words, the right software could do it. Yeah, but you raise an interesting point because they may not all agree, and ultimately it's Comcast that decides. So that's terrible. I feel bad for you. I really, you know, on the one hand, I understand why they want to, you know, keep people who are using huge amounts of data from bogging down the network. But really, they should just build out their network to handle it. It's not like it costs them that much money. I'm not really sure what their rationale is for this. I think mostly it's anti-competitive. Truthfully, I think Comcast is in the business of selling you premium content on Showtime and HBO, and what they really don't want you to do is watch all of that over the internet instead of through their cable channels. So ultimately, I feel like that's the real reason they have these bandwidth caps, not because it costs them so much more that you're using 310 gigabytes a month. I do wonder what it is that's using 10 gigabytes a day. That's a lot. I think the caps in other markets are even lower, aren't they? 250, they were trying out 250 gigabytes. What they do is they say, well, what's the top 1/10 of 1% of usage? Those are the guys we want to stop. 8888 ask Leo, that's the phone number. I haven't looked at my usage in a long time. I should probably see how much I'm using. We use a lot of bandwidth. For all sorts of things, streaming, and I mean, I'm downloading movies on iTunes and Google Play, and I'm watching movies every night. And I wonder if I'm over 300. I might be, but we have, that's why, you know, we have the business class service. Steve, Anaheim, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hey, welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Had a couple of questions for you since I've been online here.
More have been generated. All right.
Yeah. First of all, I have Windows 8.1. My last machine died, and to get a machine, a laptop with a CD on it, and these days it's kind of hard to find. But they constantly want me to upgrade to Windows 10.
Yeah.
And then I'm looking at Windows 10, and I did a start page search on that. And it says that it has built-in the end user.
You know, I have to take a break. I have to take a break. So when we come back, formulate your question. We'll get to you right after the break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
I need a snack.
You know, when you have an Easter brunch, which consists entirely of mimosas, it'd probably be important to have a little snack along with that. Nature Box time. I love my Nature Box. We get several Nature Boxes a month at the studios because our staff loves their Nature Box. Let's see what's in this today's Nature Box. I've got apple pie. Oh, love these. Apple pie oat clusters. Now, every case, they have these are nutritionist design. They have hundreds of snacks. And they're in every case, they no HFCs, no artificial flavors or colors. They're really good for you. No trans fats, of course. Much better than going to that snack machine down the hall. We don't even have a snack machine. We don't need to. We got Nature Box, right? We got the good stuff. Always simple ingredients, delicious. You could choose from sweet, spicy, savory. Hundreds of snacks to choose from, delivered to your door every month. Oh, this is the, you know what? We would never have any of these because Sarah Lane would go through all the Nature Boxes and remove them and take them home. The strawberry Greek yogurt pretzels. She loved those. Now that she doesn't work for us anymore, we've got a few. I love them. They're so good. Oh, perfect for brunch. Mini Belgian waffles. Mini Belgian waffles. This is a nice one. Cranberry pepita crisps. Cranberry and pumpkin seed pita crisps. I bet those are good. Very simple, very delicious. How about jalapeno cashews? There's a good one. Probiotic power mix. Probiotic fruit and nut. See, that's good. Go to naturebox.com. Pick your snacks. And by the way, feel free to experiment. If at any time you get a snack and you go, you know, that wasn't so good, no problem. They'll replace it next month in your next box. Right now you get 50% off your first box of delicious, unique snacks without any of the junk. Naturebox.com/twit. Let's take a look at that probiotic power mix. Oh, that looks so good. My mouth is watering. Now, I can't put it back in the bag, can I? I have to eat it, don't I? I think that's the rule. And by the way, resealable bags mean you don't have to overeat. Just have a snack. And, you know, you'll be great. Good to go for the rest of the day. Naturebox.com/twit. 50% off your first box now. If you've never tried them, you're going to love them. Naturebox.com/twit. That's good. Oh, man. I know it's mean. I'm sorry. I have no excuse. I'm a mean, mean man. Mean. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We were talking to Steve in Anaheim, and we got cut off by the inevitable commercial break. Hi, Steve. Welcome back. So you're running Windows. You're running Windows 7.
No, 8.1.
I'm sorry, 8.1, and as many of us have been threatened with a Windows 10 upgrade.
Correct. And when I searched it, asking if it has built-in malware, spyware, etc.
Yeah.
It comes back with basically when you click that I agree button, it says that you're giving them permission to watch your every move, quote unquote. Is that correct? And if so, does that apply to Apple operating system and or Linux?
These are great questions. So there are some, including my security guru, Steve Gibson, who says he will never use Windows 10 because of these privacy issues. I am not quite so adamant about it. I like Windows 10 and I use it. Windows 10 has some features built in, and they do request require your permission to use them that do send information about you back to the home office. So there's a variety of different things. For instance, one of the features of Windows 10 is Cortana, the assistant, the personal assistant you can ask questions of. Well, Cortana, first of all, needs to send your queries back to Microsoft to be processed. She doesn't understand speech locally. She understands them on the server. This is not at all unusual. So they do request the permission to do that. use your microphone, send that information back to the home office. They collect information about your preferences and likes as part of Cortana's working. Google does that with Google Now as well. You can turn a lot of these features off. If you're worried, when you install Windows 10, instead of accepting the defaults, you want to customize your install. And Microsoft does go through all of the different things they will collect, and you can, one by one, turn them off. The one that scares people that cannot be turned off, and incidentally is also present in Windows XP, Windows 7, and Windows 8, and Windows 8.1, is what Microsoft calls its telemetry. This is information it gathers about programs that have been run, how long they've been run, when they crash, why they crash, the state they're in when they crash. Microsoft collects this information and puts it under the overall heading of improving your Windows experience. And it's really not your Windows experience. They're trying to gather information about how people use Windows to make Windows more, you know, fit better their audience. If you don't like that, and I understand that, you can turn it off even further by modifying, but you need a tool called Group Policy Editor. By modifying, you can eventually turn off all this stuff. And there have been, I think, link-baity articles by people who should know better saying, oh, no, even if you turn it all off, it's still talking to the home office. Well, it is, as any computer would be, because that's called the Internet. If you want a computer on the Internet, it's going to send data out. But it's not personal or personally identifiable data particularly. It's just the data it needs to surf the Internet. Anytime you use a browser and go to a website, your Internet address, the name of your browser, the operating system you're using, the size of your window, and other things are transmitted to that website. That's called Internet surfing. It's just the way it works. So we can get awfully paranoid about this stuff. And I caution you not to get too crazy. Is Apple better? Yes and no. The browser does exactly the same thing. But I don't believe Apple is collecting the same kind of information about you or telemetry about you. Maybe they will in their next version. They've said they're going to put Siri into the next version of OS X. That's the personal assistant you talk to. It will work very similarly to Cortana. And at that point, they'll probably have to ask you for very similar permissions. And you may decide not to use them. I believe you can safely use Windows 10. It's not doing anything more than Windows 8.1 is. Let's put it that way. And if you feel like, you know, you want to lock it down a little bit, go through the settings and customize them and turn off the things that bug you. Linux probably does not do any of this. In fact, it certainly doesn't for several reasons. One, it's not a commercial enterprise. Linux is an open source product that is offered by many companies, in most cases for no charge. And those companies, in most cases, don't collect information about you. Nevertheless, the Linux browser still, every time you go to a website, tells the website your IP address, the name of your browser, the name of your operating system, how big this window size is, and a lot of other stuff. Because that's how browsing works. So there's always a little information being leaked by a computer unless you specifically really lock it down. If you want to be as secure as possible and you don't mind learning how to use it, Linux is probably the best choice. It's certainly the best privacy choice. And there are versions of Linux like Tails, T-A-I-L-S, that are designed for total security that really don't leak information. When you browse, you're browsing in incognito mode, et cetera, et cetera. So look at Tails, and you can install that. Best of all, you can put that on a USB key. Boot your anytime you want to use your computer in a private mode, you boot to that USB key, and now you're in this very private, very secure mode, which is suitable for banking and things like that. But this takes, you know, significant skills with a Z. It's not something for the faint of heart. If you're, you know, most people are going to use a consumer operating system. Apple's OS X, Microsoft's Windows 10, Android or iOS. And in every case, those operating systems pass along information to the home office. In some cases, because they need to do that. In some cases, for marketing purposes. And I think you just have to decide, is that okay with me or not? A company that does that, in my opinion, should be very forthright about what it's doing, what it's using it for. If you look at Google's terms of service, its user license agreements for its various pieces of software, I think they're very explicit about what they use, what they collect it for, how it's used. It's for advertising purposes. And you can decide there. people kind of got mad at Microsoft for Windows 10 because I think they maybe weren't as forthright as they ought to have been about what information Windows, they certainly was collecting. They certainly weren't, this is a problem that's kind of typical of Microsoft, very good at communicating it anyway. They seem to lack basic communication skills at Microsoft. I don't know why. But I don't feel it's something nefarious. That's me. I use all this stuff with its defaults. I don't turn on all the privacy controls because I actually prefer to have the ads customized to fit my interests. I don't mind that. I should mention my friend Steve Gibson has a nice little control panel he's put out. Or actually, it's not even that. It's a small application that you can install and get rid of that goes in and changes group policy settings to prevent that Windows 10 upgrade that Microsoft has been foisting on people. If you're interested in that, look for Never 10. A little small program he's written for Windows 7 or 8.1 that will disable any Windows 10 upgrades from now and forever. And he says you can run it and throw it away after you've run it because it doesn't install any software. It doesn't continue its blocking. It just disables that upgrade. Nice job, Steve. He's the guy who said, I will never go to Windows 10. Never. Never 10 from Steve Gibson. I like Windows 10. I mean, I use it. I use a Mac more, but I use Windows. And I use Linux. I like Windows 10. I want to thank Nathan Staten, our musical director. He's been spinning the tunes, making the music. Kim Schaffer, looking great in bunny ears for being here today and answering the phones. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed the show today. Tell your friends. Come back for more. And don't forget our Twit Podcast Network for more shows at twit.tv. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great day. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called Twit, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today and Tech News Tonight. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.